And welcome everyone to another episode of All Things Trek. I'm Oren.
I'm Grace.
And I am David.
And today we have a special guest who has described himself in the past as an author, a blogger, and an all-around functional nerd. That's right. Today we are interviewing Patrick Hester from the SF Signal podcast.
Hello, that's me.
And I believe, as the functional nerd indicated, you are also part of the Functional Nerds podcast. Is that correct?
Yes. Actually, the Functional Nerds podcast came first.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
I should know that. I've been listening to SF Signal for a while.
Well, we kind of keep them separate now. We joke back and forth, but we don't really cross over much anymore because Anelio kind of stays on the Functional Nerd side.
Mm-hmm.
So, quick question for those of us who aren't in the know. What are the qualifications for being a functional nerd?
Basically, the actual term functional nerd came about because I was working for a guy, and I don't know if you've ever encountered this. You probably haven't, but when you are a sci-fi fan, everybody completely understands you and gets what you're into.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
And I remember I was at work, and it was when the Google Android came out, and my boss was like vacillating on whether he wanted to get a new iPhone or the new Android. And I said, oh, well, did you see all the lawsuits about the droid name? And, you know, Lucas is kind of pissed and Star Wars is kind of going after them over that and this and that. And I kind of went on like a 20-minute rant. And my boss looked at me and he said, you're so weird. You're such a nerd. But you're functional. And I said, well, what does that mean? He's like, well, I can have a normal conversation with you, and then you go on a 20-minute rant about droid. And it kind of stuck.
Does that mean that it's correct now that we can use the phrase too nerdy to function?
There you go, yeah. You know, I've always joked that I can talk to anybody about anything.
Yeah.
And that's where I kind of think the functional comes in. You know, I am a nerd. I do love my science fiction. I love my Star Wars and my Star Trek and my Babylon 5. I'm going to throw all three of those out there to upset some people. I can also talk about barbecue, but I don't, because I think there's three rules of podcasting. We don't talk about politics, we don't talk about religion, and we don't talk about barbecue, because those are the three most, yeah, those are the three most polarizing topics in this country.
You do talk about bagels a lot, though.
We talk about bagels because of John DiNardo. And go ahead.
I was just going to say, I hear that a lot, and I'm like, I get that this is a joke. And I don't know what it is. Like, there's this bagel thing going on.
Yeah, I explained it in a recent episode. We actually talked about it because there has been some confusion over it. But essentially, John DiNardo is our bagel overlord. He's the founder or one of the founders of SF Signal. He and JP Frantz. And John is a New Yorker living in Texas.
Oh.
Goodness.
And it is, you know, it's kind of like when you talk about pizza. I was born in Chicago. For us, pizza, there's two kinds of pizzas. There's a deep dish, and then there's the thin crust. For New Yorkers, there's only New York-style pizza. And for a lot of New Yorkers, the only place you can get a good bagel is New York. And so we tease John about bagels because he is stuck in
Texas. He's a bagel snob, isn't he?
Well, he's not really. He just loves bagels. But what is funny is that if you ever see him in person, if you ever are at a convention with him, he will be looking for a good bagel. And so that's why we tease him. The other reason we make all those jokes is because a lot of times John is listening to us. He's hovering in the background on mute. And I am tempting, you know, I'm trying as hard as I possibly can to get him to go off mute and make a comment. And sometimes it works.
So can you like earn extra brownie points by mentioning Bialys or something around him?
Probably. It's just kind of fun. Yeah, no, it's just a fun thing that we do. You know, it's like an inside joke that we share with everyone.
So now that we've discussed bagels, why don't you tell our listeners what SF Signal is all about? Because I know that when I'm looking at my iPod, I feel like, you know, I'm like, I've missed a week. I'll go catch up. And there's like 10 new episodes. I'm like, what's going on with that?
Yeah, so if you just mean the podcast. So what happened was with John and Elio and I, we're both doing podcasts separately.
Mm-hmm.
And DiNardo became aware of Anelio. And his music, which is inspired by science fiction and fantasy. And so, like, he has a song called Cylon Number 6 that's based on the character from the new Battlestar Galactica.
Yeah.
He wrote the George R.R. Martin Is Not Your Bitch song based on a comment that Neil made, Neil Gaiman. And you know, we were both doing our own thing, and I was looking to have another voice on my podcast because I was tired of listening to myself all the time. And Anilio was kind of doing the same, and we kind of came together because of Donardo, and we started talking about doing a podcast. And I said, well, what we should do is we should pitch a podcast to SF Signal. And Anilio was like, well, you know, I don't know. I don't know that we're good enough for that. You know, they're pretty established within the community. I don't know that would work. He says, but you said something on your podcast once that kind of stuck with me. And I'm like, oh, what was that? He said, you called yourself a functional nerd. And he said, I think that should be our podcast. And so we started the Functional Nerds. And
history was made.
Yep. In the beginning, it was just he and I kind of talking about nerdy things. And it was very rough. And I would like scour the web for stories, and we would just talk about these things, you know, any kind of nerdy thing. And basically what we came up with was, you know, being a functional nerd, being nerdy was you could be nerdy about anything. If you are into a garden, you could be a garden nerd.
Right.
You know, it just depends on what you're into. And so we did that for a little while, and then we kind of came back around to thinking that we should pitch something to SF Signal. And rather than – at that point, we were kind of doing well with Functional Nerds, and people were really liking us, and we had been very welcomed into the genre community, which just overwhelmed us and made us, you know, kind of feel humbled. We were getting some really big names to come on the show, and that was blowing us away. And so we kind of decided that we didn't want to roll the Functional Nerds into SF Signal. And so we pitched a different idea to John DiNardo, and he had actually been thinking about it for a while. You know, he'd wanted a podcast. And again, we were very rough in the beginning. We were trying to stick to a certain amount of time, and that never worked. And eventually, Anilio just decided that there was too much time, you know, invested in both shows, and he couldn't do it right now. So he went back just to being on Functional Nerds, and kind of left me with SF Signal, kind of doing my own thing. So what I started doing was, you know, I basically started doing panels. Mm-hmm. Not everybody can afford to go to convention. Conventions are very expensive, especially if they're a creation convention. Ba-da-bum.
Oh.
And so I decided that I liked the panel idea, the panel concept. And so I started inviting people to come on panels, and we just have a discussion every Monday. And then I started pushing interviews with authors to Thursdays. And so I'm doing 2 hours a week now. And really, you know, John DiNardo has been very supportive, and he's kind of let me run with it. He's basically said, you know, do what you want to do. And I mix contributors to SFSignal.com with authors and editors and artists from genre fiction. And people seem to like it because they were kind enough to nominate us for a Hugo in 2012.
You're kind of living the podcast dream, aren't you?
Yeah, you know, I'm still waiting for those mountains of cash to roll in. But
aren't we all?
But I have to say, any success really that I've had with that podcast comes from all the great people who come on with me. Aww. You know, the people who are on the panels, the authors who agree to the interviews, and of course the folks who listen. Because without them, it would just kind of be, you know, me talking into a microphone and shouting for all I was worth.
For reference for anyone who's listening, I cannot recommend enough a lot of the discussion panels you guys have had. I think one of my favorites was probably your military sci-fi panel. That was fascinating.
Sure. Great. Well, I appreciate that. You know, sometimes those ideas come to us from other people.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Lou Anders was very big on kind of pushing us to do Sword and Sorcery, and our Sword and Sorcery panels were very, very popular. And then, from there, I started thinking about doing other kinds of genres, and that's where the military sci-fi came in. And we had Mike Cole and Gene Johnson and a bunch of other people just coming on and talking about, you know, what they love.
I mean,
can't get any better than that.
I wasn't even like, when I was listening to the Sword and Sorcery one, I was like, the question I kept asking myself is, so does Game of Thrones count as Sword and Sorcery? Because it's got swords and there's maybe some sorcery in there somewhere.
I think dragons automatically puts you in the swords and sorcery department.
Is a dragon a form of sorcery, though? I don't know.
It's kind of a genre staple, though.
That's true.
Really, he's doing like a gritty epic fantasy.
Yeah.
He really is. And hopefully, you know, he'll finish it before HBO catches up to him.
One of these days. Supposedly, one of the agreements he had to make, but when they decided to make the show, was they were like, all right, you actually have to finish this book series. Despite what we were just talking about earlier about he gets to finish it on his own time. He doesn't have to listen to people yelling at him to finish the series. We would like to hear the ending, you know. We do want to know what happens.
And there are at least two great songs about that. Anelio has his, which I love. And Paul and Storm has theirs, which I also love. It's very funny. But yeah, we kind of poke fun at Mr. Martin. I got to meet him at last year's WorldCon just very, very briefly. He's a very nice gentleman. He's very nice, you know. He was very kind to all his fans. He had a lot of fans there. And that's really how I judge a lot of authors, is how they interact with their fans.
Yeah.
And there are some who just do it wonderfully, like, you know, Gail Carriger, Brent Weeks, Brandon Sanderson. I mean, these are folks who you can tell how much they appreciate their fans, and just, you know, kind of they give them their all when they're there with them. And Mr. Martin does that as well.
Speaking of authors, so as I mentioned earlier, you are an author yourself. You have written a number of stories and novels. So why don't you tell us what kind of stuff you've written?
I'm all over the place. So I do epic fantasy, sci-fi, urban fantasy, sword and sorcery, and steampunk, just to name a few. It's what the mood hits me to write. I have a pair of short stories out in two anthologies. One
you
is called
First. A pair of shorts, though.
I'm sorry?
Would you call
yes,
them
I
a
did.
Pair of shorts, though?
Yes, yes, I would call them a pair of shorts.
Sorry.
That's okay. You know what? I will say they're not tidy whities. So, First Contact is a sci-fi adventure. It appears in Space Battles, Full Throttle Space Tales, Volume 6. And it's been received very well. You know, it's very space adventure-ish. And then another one called Charisma is an urban fantasy, and that's in an Uncommon Collection, which is a shared worlds anthology that actually one of my writers groups put out last year. I also have things like I used to have a little series on the blog called Conversations with My Cat.
Aww.
And I collected those together and put them out as an ebook last November. And then the other thing I've been doing this year is I've been putting out a new piece of fiction every month. So I had Consumption, which is a weird Western that we put out in February, and Witchcraft and Satyrs, which is an alt history fantasy mythology mashup that I put out just a couple days ago here in March.
I knew
you were going to say like Seder, like Fawn Seder, but I heard Seder and immediately thought of a Jewish Passover Seder.
Not that kind. No,
so
you're right about
the
Fawn.
Very different story, I imagine.
Yes. Yes, it is. And actually, it's set in like a rural Kentucky. So you also have, you know, beans and cornbread, moonshine, those kinds of things. I also did a couple of Trek fanfic pieces back in the day when I was much younger and stupider.
Do tell.
One was actually published in a fan fiction kind of magazine kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
The magazine's called the Hellguard Social Register, and it was all about Savick. It's like Savick focused.
Mm-hmm.
And the story was called The Other Side of the Mirror. And in it, a Lieutenant Savick uses the Guardian of Forever. She wants to travel back in time to save the Mirror Universe Spock from being killed by the Mirror Universe Kirk. And as often happens in a Star Trek story, there's some sort of storm, electrical kind of thing. And instead of going back in time, she actually travels across universes.
Well, you know, as is wont to happen.
Yeah.
Yes. Where she meets a younger version of herself who is not yet joined Starfleet, but is traveling with Spock. So it's a very interesting little story. And it's out there in the ether somewhere. I mean, if you can find a copy of the Hellguard Social Register, you are more than welcome to read it.
Now, did you know that according to the original script, Savick is supposed to be half Romulan?
Yes. In fact, they continue that on in the books and in the comics. Her mother, a Vulcan science mission to a planet called Hellguard was captured by Romulans. The women were raped and kept as slaves, and Savick was born. And Spock was part of the Federation mission that actually rescued her from that planet. And that's where their relationship started. And he sort of took care of her as she was growing up. He saw that she was placed in Vulcan. She went to the best schools. She never wanted for anything because he saw like a mirror of himself in her, because she was warring with her own emotions, being half human and half Romulan.
Mm-hmm.
Or half Vulcan and half Romulan. and, you know, him being half orc and half human.
Right.
And there's the scene in the movie in Khan where Savick is crying.
Yeah.
And
that's the only real indication we get in that movie, though, isn't it?
Yes. It's in the novelization, which, who did the novelization? Was it Vonda McIntyre?
I
believe it was. She actually played with that, and then Diane Duane and some other writers kind of ran with that, and then the DC Comics also ran with that.
Now, well, since I wasn't planning on asking this question, but since we're on the topic of Savick, what do you think of the many phases, the three faces of Savick? Because you have your original Christie Alley Savick, and then you have your Robin Curtis Savick, and then you have Polaris, I think is her name? Valeris, who was supposed to be Savick, but isn't.
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
Yes, Kim Cattrall. Oh, my gosh, I remember that. okay, so obviously...
Not watch that movie after watching Sex and the City the same way. Just going to put that out there also.
Kirstie Alley, I thought, did an excellent job. I think that was her first movie.
Everyone's going to ignore that statement.
I think she did all right. She, you know, it was her first movie, if I'm not mistaken.
No.
Yeah.
Robin Curtis played Savick much more mechanically.
Mm-hmm.
There was less emotion in her. I don't know if that was a conscious effort or what. And then, of course, her portrayal was quite brief. She didn't get a whole lot of screen time. Well, now, in the comics, they played with her a lot more.
Didn't she get a fair amount of screen time in Star Trek III? I mean,
Yeah, and then she was gone.
Yeah, she definitely... Yeah. It was kind of weird to see her show up right at the beginning of Star Trek IV, and then she's just not in the rest of the movie.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That confused me a little bit.
She's only really there to acknowledge that a movie happened before that.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think she did all right. If I'm not mistaken, in the Next Generation novels, she was actually Admiral McCoy's caretaker.
Aww.
That could very well be true.
Yeah, I believe in the novelizations that Spock, like, asked her to help McCoy or something as he was getting older. She spent some time with McCoy. I do remember that the Undiscovered Country was supposed to be Savick, and it was supposed to be her kind of, you know, betraying Spock a little bit. And they totally twisted that and got it, you know, a new character that we'd never heard of before, we'd never seen, had never been mentioned before. Let's just throw in there and see what happens, which I thought was kind of silly.
Yeah, it was a little bit, I mean, I think it works okay, but when you're watching it, you're kind of like, this would feel a lot more impactful if I had ever known who this character was.
Right. Yes, if it had been Savick, I think it would have been a kick in the gut.
Now, would you have accepted it if it was Savick? That's a question. Because, you know, the betrayal of Spock and the Federation by an established character of Savick, is that something that we could accept? Like, would that make sense for her?
If they had played it correctly, yes.
Definitely would have made the scene where he's trying to take the information from her mind more intense to watch.
Yes.
I don't know if I could handle that scene being more intense. It's already pretty intense.
Yeah, but it would make it even more intense.
Run into the kitchen and grab some ice cream intense. Go ahead, David.
Well, that's interesting because I never really had known that that was supposed to be Savick. And for years, I had a theory that I would try to convince people or just throw it out there and see how they would react to it that Valeris was actually half Romulan. And some people are like, no, you're crazy. You're reading into things. You're seeing stuff that's not there. Other people are like, oh, yeah, I see it. And so now to think back that, you know, it kind of was supposed to be Savick, who was supposed to be half Romulan, that to me kind of lends credence to that theory. And I guess is good writing that would be picked up on, that even though in the script she's just shown as Vulcan, that I got vibes of Romulan from Valeris, from Kim Cattrall's performance, and even just stuff in the script. Like, she's the one that says, oh, hey, there's Romulan ale here. And, you know, some of her comments that would be in the dialogue, not just her acting of it. But I always liked it. But then at the same time, she'd be betraying Spock, but like Admiral Cartwright and some of the others.
Yeah.
They felt that they were doing what was right for the Federation. So even though it might be a personal betrayal, she might have felt she was doing what was best for the, you know, the culture, the government. And in a way, that would make sense if that was her Romulan side coming out. Mm-hmm. Like, all this time, she was lending more to her Vulcan side, and then here comes her Romulan side.
Well, even if we disregard the idea that she could be sort of half Romulan, like Savick, I kind of like the idea of her sort of being, what am I trying to say? Character-wise, like a stand-in for Savick for Spock. Like, he's trying to sort of recreate that whole connection he had with someone, except, you know, with someone who isn't Savick, with Valeris.
Well, and to go a little bit further, I mean, if you really want to look at it, they wanted Savick.
Right.
Yeah.
Nimoy wrote that, didn't he? I think he wrote that. Because after the previous movie.
Oh, the best movie ever made, the one where with startling religious revelations. That's the one.
Yeah.
I think that's what you're talking about.
Yeah. The only thing I'll say about that movie is that it delivered the greatest line in Star Trek history.
Care to share?
Which line is that?
Yes, absolutely. Hold on a second. I actually wrote it down here somewhere because I didn't want to like misquote it. Excuse me. I'd like to just ask a question. What does God need with a starship?
I mean,
seriously, best line ever. Yeah. But I think, you know, after that, Nimoy wrote this, and he did want Savick, but he didn't want Robin Curtis. He wanted Kirstie Alley. And Kirstie Alley, I believe, was like heavy into Cheers or something at the time.
Yeah, she was on Cheers and, by then, wasn't she?
Yeah, and she was a star. And she's like, no, I'm not going to put those ears on again. And so out of necessity, they created a new character.
Yeah.
It happens.
Yeah.
I always thought it was a little bit unfortunate that in Star Trek VI, they indicate that the Romulan ambassador was like a big player in this whole plot, but he's barely in the movie. Like,
right.
I know the movie has a limited amount of time, but I think that there's a story there that we just kind of, you know, walked over and didn't see it.
And they never name him. He's just always Romulan ambassador.
The Romulan
I think Tuvok was in that movie more than the Romulan ambassador was.
Hey, continuity error.
Right.
He's not wearing the ears. I don't care what flashback says. If he's not wearing the ears, he ain't Tuvok.
Quick side story. I was on a Southwest flight. I was leaving like Vegas or somewhere, and I'm on a Southwest flight. And you know Southwest are cattle cars.
Yeah.
And I'm sitting there, and I had gotten on early and got my seat, and I'm watching the other people get on. And here comes this guy with his wife and his kids, and I'm staring at him going, God, he looks familiar. It was Tuvok.
Oh my God.
Oh goodness.
How did you just not flip the hell out?
I you know what?
Well, I'm sitting assuming there and, you didn't, since you're here and not in police custody, so
I when the Southwest flight attendant came by, I said, you know, do you know who that is? She's like, no. I said, that he's in Star Trek. That's the guy who plays Tuvok on Star Trek Voyager. And of course I get the blank stare.
The what now?
And the blank stare. Who? What?
Star what now?
What?
Star Trek?
And I really, really, really wanted to go up and say something to him, but he was with his family. And that would not be cool. So, you know, I was just very happy to be on the same plane with him, but I did not go up and bother him.
Yeah.
I had a neighbor for a couple of years that I was positive was Tim Russ. Looked like Tim Russ, sounded like Tim Russ, even acted a little bit like Tuvok. He was very, you know, stoic. And I was very young. The only reason I ever interacted with him was because he, like, shared a house with a friend of mine. And so I would go over and be like, hey, is my friend here? And he would be like, just a minute, I'll check. And then he would walk back and I was like, how is Tuvok living next door to me? Incidentally, not actually Tim Russ.
In the 90s, my cousin was into bowling, and he talked me into going out with him on Friday nights and bowling with him and his girlfriend. And I actually joined the league for a little while, but I couldn't bowl with him. They put me on another team, and it was this family, and they were all very nice. And then I eventually found out that the matriarch of this family, the grandmother, her name was Nana Graysmick, and she had put on the very first Star Trek conventions.
Wow.
And she and her friends had put on conventions for many, many years, and then they wrote a book about how to do a Star Trek convention.
Cool.
She had some great stories about a drunken Jimmy Doohan hitting on her.
Nice.
And about, you know, back then, before, you know, all the creation crap. I'm going to be very hard on creation during this whole show, by the way. That it was just such a wonderful atmosphere. And she said, you know, they would have a convention, then they would go up to, you know, a suite, and she would be in a room with Shatner, Nimoy, and all the rest of them. You know, they're just kind of sitting around having a drink and talking. And she had like knitted a blanket for Gene Roddenberry Jr. when he was born, and gave it to Majel. And I mean, she just had all these connections with them. And from that point on, I was very, very happy to be a part of their bowling team.
Oh.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
It was.
Even though I'm terrible at bowling.
Yes. So, yeah, I'm not the greatest.
This is a little an interesting piece of trivia. So we were talking about Star Trek conventions. So have you heard anything about the Star Trek London convention that they had last year?
No.
Okay. Well, everything I've heard about it was that it went very well, but apparently they were discussing, like, the people behind it were discussing not having it again the next year, because I think out of 18,000 people who went, they received 138 complaints. And I was thinking, man, they take complaints really seriously in England. I mean, people have been complaining about creation for years, and they refuse to go away.
Wow.
Yeah, I don't know.
They were complaining about, or?
No, they didn't say. I was imagining it was something along the lines of, like, your convention killed my baby or something, you know, something really serious. I think it is actually, you know, it is officially back on. I looked up their website, and it didn't look super, like, they still have the site up from 2012. But I think from listening to some of the British Star Trek podcasts that I listen to, that it's back on, but I thought that was really funny.
There have always been two aspects of Star Trek that I have never cared for. One is Paramount, and two is creation. And the two kind of go hand in hand, because it was like, let's corporatize, or however you want to use a word there, fandom.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And that's what really happened with creation. That's what kind of bothered me. Because, you know, when I was little, you could go to a Star Trek convention, pay $5, and, you know, see your heroes and see all this cool stuff and meet people who shared your fandom and the things that you were passionate about and nerdy about. And, you know, now to go to a convention, it's ridiculously expensive. Just to get the tickets to get in the front door can be ridiculously expensive. You know, and I've gone to some big conventions. I go to Worldcon, you know, and you're looking at probably at least $1,000, if not two, to go to Worldcon, depending on where you're traveling to, you know, and that's eating in the green room, or eating in the, you know, the fan room and all that kind of stuff. I've gone to Blizzard's convention, BlizzCon. I mean, that was hugely expensive.
Yeah.
And we
just had Emerald City Comic Con up here in Seattle, and oh my gosh, it has gotten very expensive.
Yeah.
They're expanding and all, but still, I only was able to afford to go because I won my ticket.
And in the beginning, it was about fans keeping alive something that had died.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, it's kind of like the brown coats in Firefly. They're keeping it alive.
Mm-hmm.
And once it kind of was alive and Paramount realized, hey, you know, we can still do something with this, then they're like, well, we need
our cut. Let's exploit the hell out of it.
Yeah, let's get our cut. And so, you know, don't sign anything, stars, you know, unless you're getting paid for it.
Yeah.
Don't give us autographs. You know, DeForest Kelly's autograph is, like, highly sought because he did so few of them.
Yeah.
And he charged for them, you know, kind of thing. And I don't know. That just bugs me.
Well, on the one hand, I can kind of understand a lot of these stars who do, as I understand it, they do get paid, like, a significant amount, which is, I think, one of the reasons why the conventions are as expensive as they are, is because these stars can, you know, afford, you know, they can demand the fairly, you know, high amounts of money. And a lot of them, I can kind of understand, because it's harder for them to get work as actors now, in particular because they're so recognizable as Star Trek characters. But I do think some of the conventions are a little overpriced. But I would be remiss in pointing out that there are still some really good fan conventions out there. I think Shore Leave, and is Farpoint still around? David, you know way more about the convention scene than I do.
Yeah, there's definitely some good fan-run conventions that are more smaller. You know, they're in size, and so they're going to be costing less, but they're also, you get to, you know, more access to the stars. You'll get to spend more time with them. You'll get closer to them and have just a better experience to some fans. I mean, some of them are really, really small, but then that just makes it more intimate. And some of the actors have also not been as in love with creation, I guess, in some of the ways they do things, because we've seen, and I don't know the details behind the scenes, maybe there's contracts or something that is going on there, but we've seen more and more of the stars doing their own autograph stuff. Like, they'll actually pay to have a vendor's table and then sell their autographs that way instead of going through creation. Sure. Some of them do it that way. Some of them still go through creation for the autograph signing and the appearances and the photo ops. But I know it's a touchy situation. And you know, even like San Diego Comic-Con, some people love that it's blown up and gotten so big and high profile and expanded beyond comics. And other people are you know, lamenting that it's too big and it's too much into TV and film and games and all this other stuff now.
Yeah. Oh yeah,
they are,
well,
trying to, like, you know, profit off of the fandom.
The guy who founded Mile High Comics here in Denver,
mm-hmm.
wrote a piece a couple years ago about how San Diego Comic Con had just become so big and so expensive that, you know, he just can't afford to go anymore. And it's not about comics anymore. And it, you know, no one goes to San Diego Comic Con looking for back issues. You know what I mean? It's like, that's not what they're there for. They're there to see, you know, who is Marvel going to bring this year? And, you know, what treasured childhood memory are they going to stomp on next summer?
Yeah.
Right, and it's not even so much about Marvel and DC all the time, because it's going to be like James Cameron and, you know, filmmakers debuting their latest movie trailer or something like that, where it's gone beyond the scope of what it was.
See, they figured out that people who like comics often like other things, and so they're like, all right, we'll get them all in here with the word comic, and then we'll be like, hey, you want to watch our movie? Come on, guys.
Yeah, there's also the fact that by sort of widening the horizon of it not just being a comic thing but being a pop culture thing, they're trying to open themselves up to more people who will want to attend, that they're kind of alienating the original group of people there, the comic fans.
Yeah, that never happens in genre fiction.
Never. Never, never, never. Heavens forfend.
All right. So, first of all, I do need to make a shout-out to the chat room. Data Logan actually pointed out that at one point they do mention the Romulan ambassador's name. His name is apparently Nanclus, and they mention it during the mind meld, the forced mind meld sequence, which I don't like watching that scene. So there's that. But I also I want to, as much fun as talking about various conventions are, I did want to ask you, Patrick, since this is conceivably why we have you on the show, how you got into Star Trek in the first place.
Yeah.
Television.
Very, very good. All right. Interview over. We can all go home.
We're all done here.
You know what? It was the original series, and I was born in the early 70s, and I was one of the children that the television was our babysitter. And we were sat down in front of the TV, and we watched, you know, Sesame Street and Electric Company and Reading Rainbow and all that kind of stuff. And then you would catch reruns of whatever on the TV. And I was born in Chicago, so we had WGN. And I remember Lone Ranger, Cisco Kid, Adventures of Zorro, and Star Trek, and The Bionic Man, and Space 1999, and all that kind of stuff would be on there.
Ooh, Space 1999, I'm sorry.
Yeah. And, you know, it was just basically reruns of Trek, because it was already off the air by the time I was born. And when I was 9 years old, maybe 10, we moved to California. And there was a local channel there, Channel 26, and they carried the show on the weekends, and I just continued to watch it. I also, you know, my dad was not around, and I had an uncle who was really into Trek. And so whenever I would see him, that would be the first thing he would ask me. It's like, did you watch Star Trek? And I would always, oh, yeah, you know, I watched this one and this one and this one, and we saw, you know, and we would kind of go over in detail the episodes that I watched. And then later on, my mom was a bartender, and she would tell, you know, I was reading very, very early, and she would tell her customers, you know, about her son that was just,
aww,
he was reading very young and all this kind of stuff. And there was some customer started bringing in boxes of books, paperbacks, and said, you know, here, you know, I've already read these, take these home to your son.
Nice.
And they were full of Star Trek books, and it was, you know, the Blish adaptions of the series. And then there was a couple of, like, original novels from the early days, and then started getting, like, the pocketbooks novels. And that really took off for me. That's when I really started to get into Star Trek. And then, of course,
while you were young. Yeah.
Yeah. And then the movies started coming out. So
how did that compare for you? Because you were, like, reading the novels either at the same time or like pretty shortly after you'd watched the actual like the original series. Like, were they did they match up? Did the connections jive correctly for you?
Yeah, so a lot of the novels took place within that first 5-year mission,
mm-hmm.
is the way they were kind of framed. And so it was very much set in that universe. And so you, when you were reading those books, you were very much into the show. Really where the continuity errors kind of came into play was between the movies and the comics.
Yeah.
Yeah, because you know you had DC running the comics at the same time as the movies were coming out. So, for example, Star Trek II: The Wrath of Khan. I'm going to spoil this for your listeners. In the end, Spock dies.
Uh-oh.
What?
And so they they played with that in the comics. And Savick took over for Spock as the science officer on the ship. And you know they kind of went forward with that, and with you know David Marcus and all this kind of stuff, and they kind of had some fun with that. Well, then here comes Star Trek III: The Search for Spock, which takes place you know like 3 minutes after the end of Star Trek II: The Wrath of Khan.
Hmm.
So in the comic book, they did this sort of elaborate retcon thing where they essentially brought everyone back to the Genesis planet and back to that moment and kind of got back in sync with the movie. It was a very weird
just
kind
kidding,
of thing
guys.
But they would have to do that every time you know a movie came out, so that was a little bit more strange.
I guess that's what happens when you don't know what the next movie is going to be, but you have to keep making your story, right? Have you
sure
I do not envy those people.
No, yeah. I don't either, because you know, so it's they're like, all right, well, they made the best story they can, and then someone like 5 years later is like, hey, your story doesn't match the movie. And like, well, we didn't know what the movie was going to be. They weren't sending us advanced copies of the script, okay?
Oh, it gets even better. Vonda McIntyre, I actually spoke to Vonda McIntyre. I did an interview with her. And I would talk to her about the novelizations that she did based on the movies. And she said sometimes there would be things that never made it into the movie but were in the novelization because it was in the script they sent her.
Have you ever seen one of, I think it may be the first Star Wars comic that came out at about the same time as the movie, and it's like once they ran out of like movie scripts to use, because this was like the original Star Wars, this was before Empire came out, and so this comic just started to go really weird. Like they ended up with this giant rabbit Jedi hanging out with them, and it was really interesting. Like I was reading some of it and I was like, you know, this is, I could see how this would go, because like the comics sort of seemed to take the idea that Han Solo was not going to stick around with the Rebellion, like he was going to go off and do his own thing, which I could see coming. I could see if you just watched the first movie, you'd be like, okay, you know, Han Solo's going to go off and do his own Firefly-ish thing.
You're talking about the early Marvel comics, and yes, the other thing that was funny was that they actually did not have the rights to the likenesses of the actors in the beginning.
Oh, good times.
So if you look at those comics,
fun artwork.
Yep, if you look at those comics, they kind of look like them, but they don't really. And then, yes, you had the Bugs Bunny character who was like universally hated by a lot of people. He was kind of like the Jar Jar Binks before there was Jar Jar.
Proto Jar Jar, I guess.
Yes, and
Jar Jar's things do kind of look like bunny ears, so.
Although interestingly enough, he is not the only rabbit Jedi in the Star Wars extended universe. In the
God, there's more.
In the Young Jedi series, there was apparently a rabbit Jedi master hanging around on Yavin the entire time. Like, I kid you not, this is a story, and like the Solo kids run into her, and she's like, "Hey, I'm a Jedi master. I'm also a rabbit."
Yeah, but do you know how she got there?
How did she get there?
Took a wrong turn in Albuquerque.
Oh.
Okay.
All right, podcast over. I'm going home.
We're done.
So when you were watching the original Star Trek show, did you have a favorite episode, just like from the original series?
Yeah, that's tough.
That's why I ask the tough questions.
I was actually thinking about that. One of the episodes that kind of stood out to me was the Doomsday Machine.
Ooh, the good one. Yeah, the Windsock episode.
Yes, I also liked that. One of the reasons I like that one is because they tied it to The Next Generation in a novel by Peter David.
Mm-hmm.
It's called Vendetta. And sort of picked up the thread of where did the Doomsday Machine come from? Why was it built? who built it, you know, that kind of thing. And it was suggested in that novel that it may have originally been created as a means to fight the Borg.
Yeah, I could see that. You're and still pretty heavy duty to fight the Borg.
Yeah, and he followed that up with a second novel where he actually plugs Seven of Nine into the Doomsday Machine, and she becomes sort of the pilot slash AI for the machine to fight the Borg who are threatening Earth.
I wonder if the Borg can adapt to having their planets eaten. I wonder if that's a...
I don't know.
They can process new information. They can adapt.
So in this continuity, who built it?
Another race that was being threatened by the Borg and were ultimately destroyed by the Borg. The machine itself was never supposed to be turned on, but during the destruction of this race, for some reason it got turned on and it just kind of went on its way.
So it's just supposed to be around there sort of as a threat?
Well, yeah, they were going to use it against them, and then when they were destroyed, it got turned on and kind of set on a course, and no one was really controlling it, and it just kind of kept going in a straight line.
Okay.
I'm gonna om-nom my way through the galaxy here, sort of yeah. The premise.
Om-nom-nomming your way through the galaxy.
Yeah, sort of like Galactus, except without a herald.
Which is probably
or good. Unicron.
You know, I've seen the Fantastic Four movies, and we all know that those are clear examples of quality. And we saw what happened to, you know, to Galactus having his Silver Surfer. Still have no idea why he even needed that guy. It's like, I'm going to bore holes into the planet, but why are you doing that? Because he's going to eat the whole thing. Why does he need you to bore holes into it?
Maybe like a, like a baby bird needs its food pre-chewed. Something like that.
It's like handing somebody an apple and then stabbing it a couple of times first. It's like, here you go.
Everybody knows that when there's little holes inside of something, it actually makes it light and fluffy.
Oh, there you go. That is true. I had forgotten that. Thank you. What about a least favorite episode?
Let me see here. You actually did send that to me in your like stuff that you sent me, and I had a bunch of stuff here. You said favorite and least favorite episode from each series, right?
Well, that is one of the questions I do plan on asking you, but you may answer it now, please.
Okay, so this is what I came up with: Doomsday Machine and The Way to Eden.
Oh man, Way to Eden.
favorite and least favorite.
So what did you not like about The Way to Eden?
Oh, don't even get me started.
Herbert. Yeah, Herbert.
Yeah. Herbert.
Come on, man.
next generation, let's go Darmok. Shaka, When the Walls Fell.
That's a really good
one. And actually, The Best of Both Worlds Part 2 I did not like.
Really?
Oh, well, you know why? You have to explain that.
Why? What didn't you like about it?
It was too easy.
The whole
we have set up that the Borg are the biggest baddest thing in the universe. They are crushing us. Nothing we can do against them. They're just batting aside all of our ships. But hey, we can sneak on board and steal Captain Picard back. I did not like that.
Yeah.
You know, the Borg, they felt comfortable leaving their ship unlocked. They didn't think anyone was going to come around and take their Picard.
Yeah, basically they live in the countryside and there's nobody for miles around, so they're fine leaving like the keys in the car, in the ignition, no problem.
So with that, you must have absolutely loved the finale of Voyager where they're just blowing Borg cubes up left and right.
Yeah,
right.
You know what? I liked that they end-capped the series well enough that they actually did get home.
Yeah,
that was nice, but yeah.
All right, Deep Space Nine?
Yeah. Anything with Quark, Rom, and Moogie.
Out of curiosity, does that include Prophet and Lace? Because that's an episode I know a lot of people really don't like.
I liked anything with the Ferengi. I thought actually that the Ferengi stood out in that as like the best part of that series.
Mm-hmm.
Well, if it hadn't been for the Magnificent Ferengi, we wouldn't have gotten Iggy Pop on Star Trek, so.
Well, and I like the Grand Nagus.
I cannot stress that enough.
I like the Grand Nagus, and really what I wanted the Grand Nagus to say just once was, inconceivable!
Yes! We all were waiting for that.
You know, that is I think a fake memory that I have conjured, because I remember him saying that. Positive he never did.
It would have been great if he'd said inconceivable, and Rom looked at him and said, "I do not think that means what you think it means."
No, what's great is apparently Nana Visitor, or was it Terry Farrell, one of them was talking to him when he first came on the show. He's like, I'm so excited. I've never gotten to do a character with a character voice before. And she and whoever else is around just kind of look at each other and they're like, wait, have you heard yourself talk? What?
And then as far as not liking things, really anything that had anything at all to do with Cisco, the Prophets, and Kai, whoever.
Kai, Nurse Ratched.
Oh, God, I hated those episodes.
Kai Ratched. A lot of people, when they talk about their least favorite DS9, and it was early on, so I guess we could kind of forgive it or try to forget it, but it was Alla Moraine.
Oh, God.
Move along, Holmes. A lot of people don't like that one.
You know, I...
Yeah,
go ahead.
Go ahead. Go ahead.
I rewatched that episode recently, and I decided that I don't hate the Alla Moraine part, like the part inside the game. Like, that I'm okay with, because, like, these are weird aliens, and they have weird, you know, customs, and so for them, this is a super serious deal. The part that I didn't like was how...
Alla Moraine is serious business.
It is serious business. The part that I didn't like was how absolutely incompetent it made the rest of the security personnel, you know, like Odo and that, you know, Lieutenant 2-episode guy, made them look completely stupid because they're, like, wandering around being like, what's going on, guys? There's a...
Hold on. At what point did you feel that any of the Starfleet security personnel on any series were competent?
You know, I generally tend to think of Odo as being pretty good at his job, and I have dreams that one day, like, a Starfleet security officer will competently solve or prevent a crime. One of these days it will happen. I know, you know, but it was just the way that they're just sort of staring at each other being like, what is going on? Like, they have no clue what procedures to follow when their senior staff is missing. They're just like kind of wandering around with a chicken with its head cut off. And then at the end, they're all mad at Quark. Like, this is somehow his fault. And it's like, because Quark cheated, I guess, and that made the aliens mad. And so they kidnapped a bunch of people. And it's like, well, you know, if I go and swear at somebody and he gets really mad and goes and, like, shoots somebody else, like, is that my fault? I mean, maybe I shouldn't have done that, but I don't think they're going to hold me responsible for someone else's actions, right?
I'm still reeling at the thought that any of the Starfleet security personnel are competent. I mean, come on. people sneak on board, they beam on board, they steal stuff, they, I mean, every single episode, you know? I mean, the security is horrible on Starfleet vessels. It's terrible.
They did I thought they did okay with if I was going to pick an episode where the security personnel seemed to do all right, it would probably be, oh gosh, now I've forgotten the name of it, the one where the super soldier, like, beams on, is like captured by their ship, and he's like running around and they're trying to track him. I actually thought that one was pretty good. Is it The Hunted? Is that the name? No,
something like that. Yeah,
I'm talking
sounds
to,
like
no it. No, The Hunted is the one with Tosk. I was thinking of it's a TNG episode with the planet that made a bunch of super soldiers and then apparently just decided to stick them on some moon and trust that the problem would sort of sort itself out after the war was done.
Oh, was that Roga Daynar or something like that?
Yeah,
I think I know which one you're talking about.
I thought that was pretty good because he is a believably badass super soldier, and like their sensors can't track him, which is something they're not used to, but the security seems to do pretty well. And, you know, they're also trying not to kill him. Like, if they were just trying to murder him dead, they would be a lot easier, right? Because they turned their phasers up to, you know, maximum explosion mode. So I thought...
Isn't that the one where at the end, like, the government or the bureaucrats are like, help us, and Picard's basically like, no, that's your problem.
Yep.
You made these super soldiers, now the war's over, so you got to deal with your own thing now.
Yeah, you made that bed, now sleep in it. The only part about that episode that I really don't like is the part where he escapes a transporter through the power of Rouge, because he's like, it's like they're trying to beam him up and he starts like dancing, and apparently the transporter just cannot lock onto you if you're dancing. I am to this day not sure what the implication of that is. Like, I don't know what he's supposed to be doing that allows him.
So basically what you're saying is if DC ever did get the comic book line back, they could cross over Star Trek with Vibe, and Vibe would never be able to be captured by the transporter.
That is exactly what I mean.
Okay.
I am excited to see that crossover. So you didn't like the Cisco as Space Jesus story at all?
No, no. And in fact, you know what? I think Avery Brooks is kind of weird.
Yeah, well, he is. He's a little weird.
His his acting style is, you know, it's like, here's Avery Brooks as Captain Sisko. Hello, I'm Captain Sisko. Here's Avery Brooks as Captain Sisko showing emotion. Hello, I'm Captain Sisko. You know, he just kind of gets louder. And he only has the two. It's like he has a normal volume and loud volume. And those are his two acting styles.
I hate to and, say it, but are occasionally you not familiar he would shake. With the Shakespearean actors doing Star Trek oeuvre?
So,
that's kind of how they roll, I guess. You get that a lot. I'm just going to say that in Star Trek.
I watched the Captains or the Four Captains or whatever it was that Shatner did, the documentary. And when he visited Avery Brooks, I kind of wanted to know what Avery was on.
Well, he's just, like, he just has kind of a weird cadence. Like, if you see him in person or if you listen to interviews with him, he just, I'm not really sure how to describe it exactly, but he definitely doesn't seem to, like, when you ask him a question, he clearly hears a different question.
Right.
So
yeah, it's like, well, the voices in my head are telling me not to answer you.
So he's got like he's kind of a strange guy in person. Like I actually thought he was a pretty good actor most of the time. There were a couple of exceptions, but I don't think I'd want to meet him in person. I think I would be very confused and not know what to do. All right, so
I don't disagree.
All right, so how about Voyager?
Voyager, I like the Scorpion because that was like the, you know, making the deal with the devil.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
You know, I did not really care for Species 8472 or whatever it was that was coming across from the other dimension. But you know what? It was decent because it showed, you know, how far they were willing to go to get home.
Well,
and then as far as what I disliked with them, anything with Kes.
Really? Kes more than Neelix?
Actually, if you know, what I would have liked to have seen was very early on them realize that they don't have enough oxygen to make it all the way unless they first jettison Kes and Neelix out an airlock.
we're keeping your ship for spare parts, though, Neelix. It's the only useful thing you've ever done is giving us an extra shuttlecraft.
Yes, let's bring on the alien who's going to cook weird foods that we don't really want to eat.
Yeah. It's the thing I don't understand about Neelix is that, like, in the show, like, this isn't something that, like, you watch the show and infer. Like, the running joke in the show is that nobody likes Neelix's food. And then, like, the other running joke is that Neelix is really terrible in survival situations, which are, like, the two things he says he's good at. Like, why is he even here?
And wasn't there, like, only one time, or maybe two, that he actually introduced them to another species?
Weren't
and
there
then it didn't work out
where
well.
His ineptitude just got people killed?
Well, yes.
Yeah.
and his as for his role as a guide, he's got about a 50-50 chance of either A, introducing them to a new species, or B, leading them into a Vidian organ trap. You know, when Neelix says to go somewhere, those are your one or your two likely outcomes. Especially since after about season, I think it's the end of season 3, Neelix straight up says, okay, we've gotten past the point of space where I have ever been. My now guide thing is now completely useless.
Yeah.
Well, and early on, they kind of set it up like...
David, go ahead.
Well, and they kind of set it up, the premise, and I was waiting to see more of it and done better, but they kind of set it up like, okay, we're lost in this new part of space, almost like we're out in the wild, we're out in the jungle or whatever, and here's our guide, here's our Sherpa, whatever, and he's going to help us navigate and deal with the aliens. I never really got that. I mean, then he becomes the cook, and, you know, it's like, I was wondering, when is Neelix going to be, like, negotiating with these, you know, races we've never seen before, and, you know, saving the day because he's their guide, and it just didn't really pan out like that. And then it got to that point where it's like, I'm done. I can't help you no more.
Yeah. I mean,
they didn't have the budget for that. So.
Yeah, there's like, the episode The Basics, which is the one where the Kazon strand the entire crew on, like, on the desert outside of L.A. So,
yeah.
And that's his moment. Like, I'm watching, I'm like, all right, Neelix, this is your time to show us you're not a complete waste of air. And, like... Then you got Tuvok, he's making his bow, and Janeway is like, we can eat these bugs because it's kind of gross, but we won't starve to death. And Neelix is kind of wandering around being like, oh man, this was really lame. Hey, you, Ensign guy, go stand in front of this cave with a space worm in it. And then, you know, and then die.
so that really what they should have done is they should have given Neelix a red uniform early on.
Mm-hmm.
Although, and just let nature take its course.
Although, unfortunately, in new era Star Trek, they went through like a color shift, So he's gonna have to be, it's gonna have to be gold. Because if you give him a red uniform, that means he's like in the command structure, which is not something we want. not ever.
Here, put this shirt on.
Captain
it's a good
Neelix,
color
I think
on you.
I
just try it out.
Threw up in my mouth a little bit hearing Captain Neelix. I don't know.
Just saying. Although I really would be interested to know what exactly how exactly that red shirt works. Because, like, the red shirt is supposed to be command, but you've got, like, you know, the captain's wearing it and the first officer's wearing it. That makes sense. Why is the helmsman wearing it? Like, is the helmsman considered part of the command branch?
He's just doing the helming thing for now until he can really get his hands on command.
All right. So,
I think it was more of a military structure kind of thing, just to throw it out there. Because Geordi was actually a lieutenant.
Yes, yes.
So, you know, you've got ensign, lieutenant, on and on and on to captain.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's why they were wearing the red uniforms.
I guess.
Data being a non-human life form, non-sentient at the beginning, I think they gave him like the gray, I don't know, or the yellow.
Yeah, I would figure that the tactical officer would be the, or security officer, because, you know, it changes what they call it, would be the one with the red uniform, right? Because, like, wouldn't he be the one who is next in line for command if the first officer is killed or taken out of action?
Well, and think back to the first season of Next Generation. Who was wearing red?
Picard, Riker, and Worf.
Oh. And, yeah, so you had Picard, Riker, Geordi, and Worf were all wearing red.
Although Worf, you know, frankly, I don't know what Worf's job was in the first season, because he wasn't security chief yet, because Yar was the security chief. They made that very clear. So Worf was just on
the bench. Yeah, in the early episodes, he sat at, like, Con and Ops, so I didn't know if he was just, like, you know, one of the helmsmen or, you know, operations or whatever, but, and then he shifted, but
he's, like, standing.
It was weird when I went back. Yeah, well, later on, he goes to the back of the horseshoe, but I remember, like, you know, in the first season, when it was brand new, we were watching it, and then when I went back to rewatch it, like, the first time, after, like, you know, seasons 5 and 6 or whatever, when they started doing the more reruns again, I was like, wait a minute, why is Worf at the helm? You know, why back in red? And it was just weird.
It reminds me of a very early episode of Ally McBeal. I watch a lot of television. One of the shows I did watch, it was the second season of Ally McBeal, and Peter McNichol's character, the Biscuit, Ally was confronting him, and she basically accused him of hiring prostitutes. And he looked at her and he goes, oh, no, that was season 1. I didn't even know who my character was yet. And he said that on the show. And I kind of feel like that's what they did with season 1. You know, there's the, what was it? They said at one point that Paramount thought that, you know, if it didn't take off, they would do 13 episodes. They would attach it to the original series and just make a ton of money off those 13 episodes.
Hmm.
So I don't think they really cared.
Yeah, I heard that. That's interesting.
Yeah. Let's just put as many people on the bridge, show some diversity. You know, how could we possibly really shake things up? Let's put a Klingon on the bridge.
Yeah, why not? I mean, like, Geordi goes from helmsman to chief engineer, which is also a really weird, you know, transfer. I don't know if he has that kind of skill set. I don't know what he was doing flying the ship in the first place. But
he was trying to be a Renaissance man, I guess.
Dr. Crusher goes from chief medical officer to, nope, we're not going to invite you back for the second season. Go away.
Yeah, well, Maurice Hurley, everything I hear about Maurice Hurley makes me hate him. Like, because he's the reason she left, because she complained about a lot of the episodes being really sexist. And this was something that didn't come out until very recently. Like, the first time I could even find a reference to it was in the cast interviews of the that were in the season 2 Blu-ray DVD. Like, they had all the main cast members who, like, they were just, you know, sitting and talking, and Gates McFadden brought up that the reason she was fired in season 2 was because she'd been complaining about the sexism, and the other cast members were like, yeah, that's what happened, and I don't think they had ever said that before.
Yikes.
Wow.
Yeah, it was really unfortunate. Fortunately, they brought her back, because Michael Piller, knew how to fix shows.
Yep.
But, all right, so why don't you tell us your Enterprise picks, and then we will go to a music break.
My what?
Your Enterprise picks, your favorite and least favorite Enterprise episodes.
I don't understand the question.
Okay, so if you had to pick an Enterprise episode that you hated the least.
I'm not sure what you're talking about.
Have you not seen Star Trek Enterprise?
Oh, that show. No. No. I tried.
You tried?
But no.
Patrick, you are after my own heart right now.
How far did you get?
Klingons running around a cornfield in Iowa.
Okay, so about 15 minutes. All right. Done and done.
Yeah.
All right, David.
So there.
Why don't you give us a music break, and then we will come back and discuss many other things.
Okay, I was about to play Where My Heart Will Take Me, but let me play something else instead. Here's some Amok Time from TOS.
That's my jam.
You're listening to the podcast and archive of all things Trek. Music breaks have been cut up due to copyright reasons. If you'd like to hear the music, please tune in live Saturday 1 to 3 Pacific Time on Trek Radio. And welcome back to All Things Trek. We are here with Patrick Hester, an author, a blogger, and an all-around functional nerd. And when we left off, we decided that Enterprise was his favorite series. It was so good, he couldn't bear to name a least favorite episode. Is kind of how that went down.
It was like Pulitzer,
right.
Really. Yeah.
That's my story, and I'm sticking to it. So I would now, if you would be so interested, I would like to talk about these Star Trek movies.
Okay.
And
whoever would have thought that Christopher Lloyd and John Larroquette wouldn't be Klingons?
And you know what? Apparently, I was surprised to find this out, that the Star Trek 3 is before Back to the Future. Like, I always assumed that one of the movie people was like, oh man, that Christopher Lloyd guy from Back to the Future, he's real cool. We should get him in a Star Trek movie. But apparently...
Nope, it was all based on Taxi, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, they went to Christopher Lloyd and they said, we would like you to be in a Star Trek movie. And he said, hold on, slow down. And said, we would like you to be in a Star Trek movie. That's my Taxi joke.
Very good, very good. And I thought it was...
Thank you very much.
It's always funny when I look in at the, like, some of the old scripts, like, notes, and it's like, so originally the Bird of Prey was supposed to be a Romulan ship.
It was, yeah.
That was something that I thought was interesting, that they kind of almost offhandedly decided, no, we'll just make it a Klingon ship, and then the entire Star Trek universe was sent scrambling, trying to figure out how Klingons got cloaking devices. It was like, when did this happen? What is going on?
There is a Romulan Bird of Prey.
Mm-hmm. It's the...
And actually, it's the ship that Sarek was flying before he was Sarek. What was that episode?
Balance
Original
Terror.
Series? Yeah, Balance of Terror.
We all know that Sarek was on a deep cover intelligence assignment within the Romulan Empire. How he survived getting blown up by Kirk and his son, I don't know.
Another
little bit of a quick trivia was that Mark Leonard was the one actor who played all three primary TOS aliens. He was Sarek, he was a Romulan commander in that episode, and then he was the very first Klingon that we see with ridges, or the Klingon commander in the motion picture.
Oh,
he was the one that said, look, a giant energy cloud. Let's shoot torpedoes at it.
Blow it right up.
The thing that I always thought very early on was that they kind of... Klingons and Romulans, I felt like they could exchange them on any of those episodes, and they wouldn't have cared. You know what I mean? It's like,
yeah.
If we just stuck the Romulans in here, we don't have the budget for the Romulans this week. Well, then let's just do Klingons.
Well,
it felt like interchangeable.
Being that when you put the Romulans in an episode because they didn't, at that point they didn't have the forehead ridges for the Romulans that they got in TNG. Whenever you put the Romulans in an episode, it kind of has to involve a little bit more from Spock, because Spock looks exactly like a Romulan, and there's always going to be the question of, well, what's going on with that Spock? How do you feel about these Romulans?
DC Fontana and Diane Duane kind of did a lot early on with the Romulans. And I know Diane Duane did a lot of books, like The Romulan Way, My Enemy and My Ally, and then Spock's World, which really kind of fleshed out the two cultures as far as Vulcan and Romulans are concerned. Mm-hmm. And before that, like I said, you could have just, it's like bad guy of the week. Who do we want this week, Klingons or Romulans?
Yeah, there's not a huge distinction, although the Enterprise incident is probably my favorite TOS episode, and that was written by DC Fontana and involved the Romulans. And I don't think the Klingons would have worked in that context, just because you needed to have, like, a little bit of extra temptation for Spock with this Romulan commander who looks a lot like a Vulcan. But all right, so we're talking about movies. Which is your favorite movie?
So, in order, I like Khan.
Okay, very good. Good choice.
Undiscovered Country.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Voyage Home, Search for Spock motion picture. If we're talking about Next Generation, I liked First Contact. I thought that was excellent. It was easily the best of the Next Gen movies.
Mm-hmm.
Generations taught us that Klingons don't know how to turn off the cloaking device and raise the shields.
Look, it takes a while to reach both of those switches, okay? They're really far apart on the console.
Yeah, it's kind of like also in Undiscovered Country. We can't turn the cloak off and raise the shields and quote Shakespeare at the same time.
It's just too hard.
Yeah, we're not multitaskers in the Klingon race. Insurrection, well, okay, it's not great. Same with Nemesis. And really, I felt like all those movies, the Next Gen movies anyway, they struggled because they didn't know what to do with the other cast members.
Yeah.
It's like, let's focus on Picard and Data and their adventures, and then let's have some funny moments with Worf and Riker. And, oh, there's Dr. Crusher in the background. Geordi doesn't
want to
wear the visor
anymore. The ship.
Yep, and Geordi doesn't want to wear the visor anymore, so.
Yeah, I mean, at least in First Contact, I felt like the other characters had a decent amount of stuff to do, like, you know, like
it was a good balance.
Yeah, like Geordi and Riker are kind of geeking out over Cochrane mm-hmm. down on the planet, and like Troy at least got one cool scene where she got to get drunk with Cochrane. She doesn't do a whole lot. She does, you know, tell the EMH to do a dance.
Yeah, let's get the EMH in there so we can boost Voyager's ratings.
You know, why not? I don't think
that worked.
He is pretty much the best character from Voyager, in my personal opinion. So we were talking before the show started. We were discussing Generations, and you had actually brought to my attention that there was an alternate ending to Generations that I had never heard of.
Yes.
And you've seen it, like so. This.
Yes.
I want you to describe it, please, for our audience.
So in the original ending, Malcolm McDowell's character, and I don't remember his name. He was one of Guinan's race.
Sorin, Tolian Sorin or something like that.
Yeah, something like that. He's trying to reboot everything so he can go back and see his family and kind of live in that little bubble with his family. And, you know, Kirk and Picard are going to stop him. And Malcolm McDowell's character, like, shoots Kirk in the back and Kirk dies. And then it's up to Picard to save everybody.
How far into the scene does that happen?
It's like very, very quickly. I mean, it's like, boom, you know, he kind of shoots him in the back. They split up to do something.
Stop making those eggs.
Right. You know where they split up to, like, go do different tasks?
Mm-hmm.
And at that point, you know, Malcolm McDowell sees Kirk and, like, shoots him in the back. And then Picard, you know, it's all up to Picard. And they tested that with audiences, and people were pissed.
I cannot.
This is not how James T. Kirk is supposed to die. He's like a hero for so many people. You know, how many people grew up with Kirk as their hero?
You can't go out like a punk.
No, and I think even Shatner was upset with it. And so they ended up reshooting it, and that's the scene that you see now.
No.
Where it's a little more heroic. It's like he's battling with them, and then, you know, stuff happens, and then, what is it, the bridge collapses?
Yeah,
the bridge falls
on him.
Yeah.
Now, I have to admit, when I first heard that, my reaction was, because I didn't know any of the specifics, all I heard was that Soren shoots Kirk. I was like, that actually sounded better to me. And then, of course, I found out that it happened really early, and Kirk didn't really do a whole lot in that version of the scene.
Correct.
I can't help but wonder if maybe a simpler solution, rather than reshooting the whole ending, would have just been to have Soren shoot Kirk later under, like, maybe a little bit more heroic circumstances.
Maybe. There's actually been a lot of stuff. I actually have an action figure, mm-hmm. not a doll, it's an action figure, of Kirk from that other movie between Star Trek 4 and Star Trek 6, where he was...
Star Trek 4.5?
Yeah, where he was doing high atmospheric skydiving from a starship. That was actually seen in that movie, and they replaced it with him climbing on Yosemite. Because it was less expensive to do.
I thought the skydiving scene was supposed to be at the start of Generations.
Was it Generations? I thought it was for that other movie.
No, I'm almost positive now, because you are right. They did have, like, Shatner really wanted to have, like, a high altitude skydiving scene, and they just couldn't do it. But I am pretty sure it was originally Generations.
Maybe it was. They did release the toy, though.
Yeah, which is kind of funny. So the toy for a scene nobody got to watch.
Exactly.
It's the ultimate hipster toy.
And I have one in a box somewhere, still in its original packaging. So there.
Because it was supposed to be like, you know, Kirk is like trying to, I guess trying to get an adrenaline rush because he's bored with retirement is sort of the implication of that scene. And it's supposed to lead into his whole, like, every time something happens on the Enterprise B, he's like, I'm going to take command. And Scotty, you know, has to say, Kirk, is there something wrong with your chair? Which is totally not, that totally wasn't supposed to be Spock. You know, we all know that that role was clearly written for Scotty.
But yeah, they originally wanted it to be, I thought in Generations, didn't they want it to be Spock, McCoy, and Kirk?
Yep, that was the original plan.
Yeah.
Which is,
Nimoy has had like this, he's had like a love-hate relationship with Spock for decades. He actually wrote a book called Spock Must Die.
Did he?
Yes, I have it. It's on my bookshelf.
I've read I Am Not Spock. I didn't know that there was a Spock Must Die.
Yeah, I think he wrote that one. There was a couple different books. I mean, he's gone back and forth with, you know, liking it, not liking it. So has Shatner. You know, Shatner for a while didn't want to talk about Star Trek and didn't want to be associated with Star Trek. I think they've all gone through that at one point or another.
Mm-hmm.
And it is kind of rough, you know, that they do get typecast. Even the people in the background kind of get typecast.
Yeah. Sometimes. And I can understand why Nimoy and Kelly wouldn't want to do Generations, because they're barely in the movie. They're basically just there to kind of, you know, give Kirk like a Greek chorus to bounce off of. But I just
right. It, well, in one interview, I remember.
Sorry, go ahead, David.
Well, I remember one interview about it after it happened, and they interviewed Nimoy about it, and he said that he turned it down. And I remember, you know, I like to have a decent vocabulary, but other times I am like, ooh, what is this word? Leonard Nimoy said he turned it down because he felt the role was perfunctory. And I'm like, ooh, what is that? And so I scrambled in my dictionary. But he basically said, like, he would have done it if there's a bigger role or if Spock did, you know, was a short time on screen but had something powerful or impactful to do. But if it's just going to be like, you know, waving to those people with the camera and then it's all about Kirk, that he felt that wasn't enough for him to come back to do it. And so we get Chekhov and Demora Sulu and, you know.
Yeah. And the part that really weirded me out and made me sad was that they didn't even like change the roles at all. It's like, so we've got, you know, so we've got Scotty and Chekhov. It's like, well, maybe those aren't the two we originally wanted, but come on, let's do like a little bit of a rewrite of the script. Let's give them something that's more in, you know, more in line with their characters, as opposed to, you know, the bizarre choice to send Chekhov off to be a doctor. It's like, what? When has Chekhov ever demonstrated medical skills?
In the later seasons of Buffy the Vampire Slayer, Joss Whedon was very busy. He was doing some other things, but he still had script approval. And one of the things that he would do is he would look at the scripts and he would tell his writers, you have written this line for Xander, and this is not a Xander line. This is a Willow line. And that's what you're talking about with Generations. This is not a Chekhov line. This is a McCoy line. And they did not change it. And that's just lazy writing.
Yeah, I thought it was personally just kind of insulting to James Doohan and Walter Koenig. While we're on the topic of,
if they are the guys that you are able to get for the movie, respect that's what you're working with and who you're working with.
Yeah, exactly.
So. Yes.
You know, one of the things that weirded me out a little bit was the so Kirk goes down to fix the deflector jet or the deflector thing, right? And that ends up being super dangerous, and that ends up like getting him stuck in the Nexus. But at the beginning, before that, he actually gets sucked out into space, they had no way of knowing that the space lightning was going to hit that one particular part of the ship, right? So why did they send Kirk there to be like a superhero and not one of the engineering staff that was already down there?
wasn't it that like I think the premise was that it had to be him. It's like, you know, he was kind of in command, but he wasn't really. And, it, you know, it was just such a bad movie.
Yeah. I think to me, the biggest disappointment in that movie was like the part where the Enterprise gets its butt kicked by one tiny bird of prey. And it's like, yeah, okay. So the bird of prey can shoot through its shields. But I mean, look, the Enterprise is like 10 times its size. Just, you know, just shoot it with your guns until it stops.
So, you know what, Generations, you could tell that it was being written by the people who were in control of Star Trek on television, because Generations had a lot of the Trekno babble that was very popular on the Next Generation.
Yeah,
you know, we're going to reroute power through the secondary ODN conduit on deck 4.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that kind of stuff. And when Kirk gets down to the engineering thing, it's all the isolinear optical chips. Whereas before, you know, in the other like Star Trek movies, they never had that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
And the captain, you know, the captain of the Enterprise B is, you know, he's trying to envelop them in a warp bubble and do that. You know, it's very Next Generation jargony.
Mm-hmm.
The second problem is they did shoot it on the same sets that they used for the Next Generation series. They didn't break the sets down. They just turned the lights down. And they turned the lights down to cover up the flaws that would show up on the movie screen that don't show up on the television screen. You know, it's kind of like how they when they did the Trouble with Tribbles anniversary episode of Deep Space Nine, and they digitally remastered the original Trouble with Tribbles, and they found that, like, Spock's uniform had coffee stains on it that they never saw before. And they had to digitally edit the, you know, and they did all this stuff to get rid of the coffee stains. It's kind of like that. They turned the lights down so you wouldn't see the flaws in the television sets, you know? So they didn't really have the budget. And they kind of rushed the whole thing to get it going because they really needed to want to, they really needed and wanted to do a movie.
Yeah.
And then as the Next Generation movies went on, they suffered from having this very strong and diverse cast with the Next Generation. Yeah. And that made it very difficult for them to tell cohesive stories that are going to include everyone. They did it really well with First Contact, but they kind of missed with all the other ones.
Mm-hmm.
I think the problem of that was that they would try to include everybody. And like,
exactly.
Like you were saying, some of the movies were like Data Picard. And I thought, okay, that's cool. Now the next movie could be like, you know, Riker and Troy's focus. Or the next movie could be Data and Geordi or something. But then I guess some fans would say, well, where's my Picard or where's my this or, you know.
There's so just no pleasing.
It seemed like, yeah, because that's what would happen with episodes, right? You would have the Riker episode or you would have a Troy episode. And it seems like in the movies, they could have still done that. Like, you know, give everybody a little thing to do, but then make it this plot is mostly centered around this character. But they never really did that. I guess they figured it has to be Picard.
Right.
You know, as the captain, and so then who is the second character after that?
Well, the original movies kind of focused on Kirk, Spock, and McCoy as the Holy Trinity of Star Trek, right? And then it was very similar to what they did with the episodes. There were these little vignettes on the other crew members. So you would have, you know, Chekhov and the nuclear vessels. You'd have Uhura with the young lieutenant, you know, Sulu with the security guard and the guy calling him Tiny. The Excelsior kind of stuff. Scotty, you know, he would have
Hello,
his little
computer.
Comedic moments.
Yeah.
Hello, computer. Or, you know, I know this ship like the back of my hand. Dong.
Movie is that? I don't remember that.
But they
Star
were,
Trek movies.
They were there, but they were never really the focus. But with the Next Generation movies, they were focusing on Picard and Data, like you said. And sometimes they would have Riker and Worf, and, you know, they'd have these little comedic moments. It was really funny that Worf was still on Deep Space Nine, so they had to come up with a reason for him to be there.
Which
like, oh, I'm on leave.
Kind of, they cared about less and less as each movie happened. You know, like in First Contact,
right.
It was like, well, we pulled you off the Defiant that for some reason Sisko wasn't commanding. Don't ask any
right.
questions about that. Just keep going. And then in Insurrection, it was, well, I was on leave. And then in Nemesis, it's like, Worf, what are you even doing here? Worf, whatever. You know, I was at the wedding and I just kind of beamed up with everybody else.
It's like the difference between a novel and a movie. You can do way more in a novel than you can in a movie. And you can do more on a weekly television show than you can do on a movie. And The Next Generation as a television show had more depth of thought in it. You know, it was what Roddenberry originally wanted for Star Trek. He got to put that in there. And then they're doing movies, and now suddenly they have to do these big action flicks. And they reversed, I felt, they reversed Picard and Riker's role, because suddenly Picard's running around doing everything.
Yeah.
And Riker is sitting in the captain's chair all the time.
Well, you know, I can't help but wonder if maybe that had something to do with Patrick Stewart, because apparently Patrick Stewart just really wanted Picard to be an action hero. Like, it makes me...
Wouldn't you?
No, I would not. To be honest about it, Picard's not an action hero, and I can't help but feel like Patrick Stewart did not understand that character. Because he's always, like, talking about how Picard needed to have more sex and guns and needed to go dune buggy racing. And it's like, what about Matt Picard?
I think Patrick
Captain
Stewart...
Sex and Guns Picard.
Yeah, I think Patrick Stewart was still upset that he was unable to defend his castle without Arthur's help in Excalibur. And that Paul Atreides, you know, was taken away from him in Dune. You know, he just was a sucky security officer. So I think that's really where all that came from.
At least he got to fight with that weird prism shield thing. It's just better than nothing.
Something like slow knives and shields. And, I don't know.
You know, I think Generations really was a rushed mess. They really rushed to get that movie out because... You know, the series ended and they wanted to get that movie out. It was kind of like the X-Files movies. Let's just put a movie out this summer, see what happens.
Yeah.
I remember some people saying that they needed to have a movie because we just had, not just had it, but at that point we had Star Trek VI and there was Michael Dorn in that movie. And that was, you know, while TNG was on, still going, if I remember right. And then everybody knew that was going to be the last movie with, you know, Kirk and McCoy and all that. And then everybody knew... At some point, TNG is going to get their movies. And some fans and I guess some executives or whatever felt we have to have a movie that like passes the baton where we see them together. And I felt and a lot of other people have said that you didn't really need to do that. You could just let the TNG cast, I mean the TOS cast have their movies and that ends. Then some time in between and then give the TNG their movie. I think it felt, you know, forced to put them together crazy time travel thing or something.
So why would they have to pass the baton twice? Because they already had McCoy in the very first episode of The Next Generation.
Yeah that they was also had, a really good way to pass the baton right there.
Yeah, they also had Scotty.
And Spock.
Well, and I think the thought there, and it, not that I agree with it, but I think the thought was that it was in the movies because maybe some of the people only go to the movies and not, you know, the casual moviegoer who goes to see the Star Trek movies or the Star Wars or the big, you know, sci-fi aliens or whatever, but they don't watch the TV shows all the time, that, you know, it was having to do it again for the movies. And maybe that's the difference between like CBS and Paramount, because, you know, Paramount controlling the movies, I don't know, it just seemed like they shouldn't have. They didn't need to do that.
Yeah.
And the way we got was just forced and rushed.
One thing that I've always wondered is that, cause if you look at, obviously, the Star Trek, the original series, does not look anything like the Star Trek movies, right? They've got different uniforms. The Enterprise looks completely different. Everything about the visual aesthetic has changed, especially in Wrath of Khan onward. Like, you know, the motion picture was still, they were still trying to figure out what worked. And in Wrath of Khan, there's a completely different visual aesthetic. I can't help but wonder if maybe, and this is probably a budget issue, but if TNG would have worked better if they had just been like, all right, so there are these things about TNG visually that do not work on the big screen. Like you were saying, all the flaws in the sets and the costumes, like those zippers they have on the back of their uniforms are really obvious on the big screen.
The camel toe. Gotta get rid of that.
Yeah, I can't help wonder if maybe... The TNG movies would have done better if they had just gone with a complete visual revamp, which they kind of did in First Contact, right? I mean, you know, they end up with a completely different looking Enterprise. It's actually a different Enterprise. They're not trying to even pretend it's the same ship. And their uniforms are different, and sort of the bridge looks different. I if they had started with that, with Generations, I can't help but wonder if maybe the show would have, if the series would have had like a slightly better arc as far as its movies goes.
Even the uniforms in the movies, they couldn't decide which one to wear.
Oh, well, yeah. Well, I mean, in Generations, that was really weird. Some of them are wearing the TNG uniforms, and some of them are wearing the Deep Space Nine uniforms, and it's like, what's going on here, guys?
And
you've got to coordinate, man. There's no coordination here.
I actually did a post on my blog when the G.I. Joe movie came out. If you look at the Cobra people, like that are running around the Cobra base, it looks like they're wearing the Deep Space Nine uniforms. So I'm wondering if like they didn't buy those in bulk from Paramount or something and put all the Cobra people in those uniforms because it looks like the exact same uniform.
Hmm. Well, it would hardly be the first time. So it's got like the colored shoulder pads.
Uh huh.
Black.
Yep. I even did screen captures to show people.
Hmm. Because, I mean, when Deep Space Nine first started and they had the different uniforms, I just assumed that, well, you know, this is the uniform that the station, that, like, space station people are wearing now. Because it was, you know, if you were from, the Enterprise crew would be wearing their uniforms, like Picard, and then even O'Brien when he first showed up, I think. And then they would change, and then when like, Dax and O'Brien and Julian, like, came onto the station, they would change into the new space station uniform. I just sort of assumed that was a thing. And then in Voyager happened, and they were wearing the Deep Space Nine uniforms, and I was like, okay, I guess now the whole Federation wears these. It was a little unclear what the timeline of those uniforms are.
And welcome to Star Trek The Uniform Chat.
I think we've had at least one episode on Star Trek fashions, and how apparently if you're not in Starfleet,
yeah, I'm pretty sure I was there for that. So
if you're not in Starfleet, it's all Earth tones. Everyone wears brown. If you're
unless you're a Vulcan, then you wear weird patterns. You wear
or
a lot
Ferengi,
of
Ferengi, because then you're gonna Ferengi. You're gonna have like paisley and tie dye, yeah, and all kinds of.
And if you're anything but human, you will wear lamé. Lots and lots of lamé.
Look, it turns out that space is just full of lamé mines, okay? That stuff is coming out. Like, they are finding that stuff faster than they can harvest it, okay? They need something.
That's what design students in the future do. They're sent to mine the lamé mines.
At least on the original series, they would run across a species who's like wearing animal skins or something.
Yeah.
Well, in TNG, there's that one episode where Wesley falls on the grass and has to die, and they're all running around. Like, everybody just runs everywhere, and they're kind of wearing, like, handkerchiefs.
The place where they all jog, yeah.
I did, like, in the very first episode of The Next Generation, it's like, not only are the ladies wearing the really short skirt, yeah, but the guys are wearing that, too.
Yep.
Yeah. I really wish they'd stuck with that. It was entertaining, to say the least.
It would have made Away Missions very interesting.
I know, right?
Yeah. I gotta say, like, watching some of the original series episodes, I feel really bad for Nichelle Nichols, because that costume that she's wearing, I mean,
yeah,
it's just not, that's not a uniform, that's a fetish outfit. And you can see that she struggles with it in certain scenes, because it is so short, and she's just like,
yeah,
right, I have to keep this in place while I'm doing whatever blocking the director has told me to do.
And yeah.
It's like, I'm sorry, Nichelle. I'm sorry.
Meanwhile, Shatner gets all the eyeliner.
Yeah. Hog.
Well, you gotta get it. You gotta
Hog
get it.
All the eyeliner.
But I'm just thinking, if they were still wearing those uniforms in Next Generation, like every Away Mission, there'd be somebody who would end up on like an air grate, and they'd be like, "Damn it, O'Brien, again! Every time, come on!"
So speaking of
that's why Scotty never wore a kilt on the ship.
Speaking of O'Brien, did you ever feel the desire to see a Deep Space Nine movie?
No.
No. Not really.
What would a Deep Space Nine movie be? Really?
I don't know. I'm honestly not sure. I'm glad they didn't make one, but
I would rather see a Babylon 5 movie.
Oh, that's rude. That's rude, man. Babylon 5 and talking about Deep Space Nine. It's bad manners.
Sorry. But hey, you know what? That's how I feel. I mean, Deep Space Nine, so my experience with Deep Space Nine was, number one, it was not carried by the same network locally as the Next Generation. So often they had it competing against Next Generation.
Huh.
Which I thought was quite rude.
No, that's too bad.
It's a poor choice for them.
Number two.
Yeah, we had it on the same station here, but that sucks.
Well, the Next Generation was on an independent channel. Deep Space Nine was on a CBS channel. So the other thing that would happen quite often is they would be showing football or baseball or something like that. And then they would say, and we now join our regularly scheduled program already in progress. And you get to see the last 20 minutes of Deep Space Nine.
Oh, yeah, that happened to me. That's why I hate baseball, is because I would be trying to watch Deep. For me, it was Next Generation and Deep Space Nine. I'd be trying to watch them, and the baseball game would go along, and they'd either just not show the episode, or I'd miss the first half.
And then you'd find out later that they are contractually obligated to show the entire episode, and what they would be doing is they would be showing it at like 3 o'clock in the morning, but they didn't advertise it. So I had that kind of going, which was very annoying. I never really cared for Sisko. I liked Dax 1. And I liked O'Brien. Kira was okay. You know, I felt like she was a little weird. But she was like the best of the Bajoran characters.
Yeah.
I love Kira.
Actually, one of my friends, his sister named her daughter Kira Nerys.
Oh, that's kind of
so there
cute.
Is a Kira Nerys in the world. And Kira Nerys is a very lovely little girl. She's a very nice child. Who
you
has
think
no
she'll
idea
be a terrorist when she grows up?
No, she has no idea what her name means, which is kind of funny. but you know yeah. what? Bashir was hit or miss with me. I remember Garak was amusing in the beginning, but the more they told us about him, the less I liked him.
Oh, yeah. You cut me deep, man. Garak is my favorite character. There is a knife in my heart, like right now.
I felt like they overcomplicated him. It was so much better when he was a mystery. Yeah. And we weren't sure what his motivations were or why he was helping Bashir. Or was he really helping Bashir?
Yeah.
Mystery forever, man. He's got to be explained eventually.
No, it doesn't. Why?
Well, because otherwise he'd be lost. well, okay. So in truth, I think that Garak, I think that if he had, like, there was no real way to do the storyline they were doing and keep him a complete enigma forever. Because, like, they're invading Cardassia. They continually ask for his help more and more. Eventually, they're going to find out. And we don't ever find out what he was banished for. We don't learn exactly what that was. And I don't think we ever learn the exact nature of his grudge with Dukat. Or the grudge that Dukat has for him, anyway.
Yeah. He kind of got Chris Carter'd, didn't he? There was no way they could keep his whole thing going without making it disappointing after they built it up the way they did early on, isn't it?
Well, and you know what?
And as much as I love Garak, I would have to say that, especially with the Dominion War and the Cardassian stuff, it kind of seemed like Garak was at times their easy out, where it's just like, oh, we'll just get Garak to do it. And I felt at times like, why would Garak do some of the things he did?
All right, well,
unless it's like, you know, saying I'm a good guy. But I mean, I still love Garak, and I think Andrew Robinson is just a great actor, and that character was awesome. But I think there's always, you know, issues with some of the long-standing characters.
Right.
Yeah.
I'll save my Garak defense rant for later, you know, for another show, because we only have about 10 minutes left, and I wanted to ask you what you thought of Star Trek 2009.
Okay, so JJ Trek, as I like to call
yes,
it.
Yes, well, JJ verse.
Yes, JJ Trek. I did like it. I think it works for what it is, which is a space adventure movie. It has these, you know, the Star Trek flavor. It definitely reinvigorated the fan base for Star Trek, which was sorely needed.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
And it brought new people and fans to Trek, which is also sorely needed in order to keep Trek going, you know, into the 21st century. One of the problems that I see at science fiction overall facing is a graying fan base.
Right.
Yeah.
And so we need to find new ways to engage younger fans and bring them into the fold. And J.J. Trek did that very well. You know, it was very flashy, very kind of light science fiction adventure. And that plays well with movie audiences.
Now, I suppose here's a question. If the point of new movies like that is to try to get fans interested in science fiction, do we want them interested in stupid science fiction, I guess is my question? Well, because, I mean, like, I liked the JJ movie, but I only liked it because of the characterization. The actual science fiction is terrible. Like, you've got the black hole that sometimes sends you back in time.
The black hole, yeah.
You know, it sometimes will and sometimes won't, and there's no explanation for why it only does that sometimes. You know, they've got the drill that they drill into planets, even though they showed they don't have to do that. It's like, why are you doing that?
Because they can.
They've got the supernova that's going to destroy the galaxy. I mean, it's to the point where I hesitate to even put science in front of the term fiction. Like, I know that that's a great that's a fuzzy line, obviously, but. So how
it's
sorry, go ahead.
No, I'm trying to say this nicely. Look at the top that's movies good. In Hollywood.
Mm-hmm.
Your like highest grossing movies. Typically they're horribly, horribly stupid.
Yeah.
But they're entertaining.
That's
and you if you look at Star Trek's history, you originally had Gene Roddenberry trying to do something that was very thoughtful. And, you know, the network executives said, oh, my God, this is horrible. You have to change this. We have to have some adventure. And that became, you know, the Star Trek that we knew. And he snuck in thoughtful here and there. Science fiction is really good at sneaking in things that make us go, huh, without us realizing it. You know, it's like the best teacher you ever had that afterwards you didn't realize how much they taught you because they did it so well. Science fiction is kind of like that. You know, it allows us to take a look at ourselves as a society in a way that, you know, doesn't necessarily insult anybody or make anybody feel uncomfortable. And that's why, you know, you had Star Trek looking at racism. You had Star Trek looking at the Cold War, you know, communism versus democracy, America versus Russia. Later on, you had, you know, human rights episodes of The Next Generation where Picard is, you know, being held and tortured. These are things, you know, where we're watching these things and we're not realizing that what they're doing is they're mirroring our own society and our own world.
I thought they were just doing like a BDSM episode with four lights. I was confused. I was like, wait, am I supposed to be intrigued? I thought I was supposed to be.
Warren, you're into some weird stuff.
Look.
Yeah, just go put that out there.
So those things work well in novels, and they also work well occasionally on television. But when we get to science fiction and genre movies, they tend to, because they're so incredibly expensive, what they really want is just a bottom line profit.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that's so what JJ
the other side of that, or another factor of that, is, you know, novels is one thing, but with television, it's free. You just turn on your television and watch it. Where they know that in the movies, people have to go buy the ticket, and they're going to try to get the most amount of people to buy the ticket. And, you know, to play to a wider demographic, you kind of have to, not in a mean way, but kind of dumb it down. You know, people want a popcorn adventure through, you know, roller coaster ride with lasers and stuff and explosions and lens flare. But
sure.
And Chris Pine.
In fact, I'm just thinking about it. I'm kind of blinded by the lens flares right now.
Yep. Whoosh.
And to reinvigorate the franchise, but also to get it to a wider audience, JJ, you know, he said in the commentary, they kind of look to Star Wars.
Yeah.
And in a way, there's not a whole lot of science in Star Wars. I mean, it's like, you know, visceral, it's emotional, there's,
that's,
you know,
space
fantasy elements.
Sci-fi thing, isn't it?
Well, I'll right. Throw something out there. We only have a couple minutes left, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So if you look at the original Star Trek and what Gene was trying to do, he never saw the technology as being something that you were supposed to focus on. He wanted it to be a tool like a hammer.
Mm-hmm.
You don't have to explain where the hammer came from or how the hammer was developed or the science behind the hammer. It was a hammer. And that's what he wanted with the original Star Trek. He didn't want us to focus on the technology. He wanted us to focus on the human characters and the story.
And how the technology was being used.
It's just a tool.
Yeah.
And that changed in later years with Next Generation. They wanted things to be based in a reality of science. And that's because by that point, you know, so many engineers, so many people had been inspired by Star Trek to go into their fields. And they were starting to get criticism from people saying, you know, well, how does the, you know, you can't use a transporter because of Heisenberg's uncertainty principle. And so then you've got Geordi saying, oh, the Heisenberg compensator is not working right now, Captain. We're going to have to take a shuttlecraft. You know, they became very cognizant of what was going on and the criticisms that they were getting, you know, leveled at them. So when you come back around to JJ Trek, he's going back to sort of the, you know, it's a MacGuffin. It's just something there. You know, I'm waggling my fingers at you. Don't pay attention.
Right. I can't help but feel, though, if we're really using Star Wars as our example, at least for the most part, the original Star Wars movies were consistent in the way their technology worked. I mean, there's plot devices, obviously, but or plot holes, but there's nothing as glaring as the black hole that sometimes sends you back in time. I mean, if the black hole always sends you back in time, okay. I mean, that's bull honky, you know, real science-wise, but sure, that can be the conceit of this.
Honky, Orin. A honky is something very different.
Bull honky.
No!
And since when do phasers shoot like automatic weapons?
Yeah, I mean, if they do that now, okay, sure, why not? I don't know. I would really like to know why Sulu is carrying a fold-out sword in an era where everyone has a hand energy weapon that can, like, blow you away, but, you know.
Because he's
special.
And cool. Because he's awesome, Orin.
All right. So what?
Because he can.
What would you like to see for the 2013 movie? You know, the one that's coming out today.
I would like to see them not retread old stories. Why bother rebooting it if you're only going to recast characters and reshoot and retell what's already been told? So I don't think they should do Khan. I don't think they should do Gary Mitchell. They have what they did was very, very clever in that they didn't really insult the long-term fans. They just said, the timeline has been rebooted. Everything's open to us. So if everything's open to us, why not play with that instead of going back and retreading everything?
I agree with you there.
It's ridiculous to expect them to, you know, quote unquote, reboot Star Trek II: The Wrath of Khan, because it, given where they are in the timeline, really what they would be rebooting would be Space Seed.
Yeah, I'm going to be really disappointed if it ends up being Khan. I mean, it may or may not be Khan. I won't believe anyone who tells me it is or it is not Khan until I'm actually in the theater watching the darn thing.
I think it would be so much better if it's just revealed that Cumberland's character is actually Sherlock Holmes.
Yep, I'm just thinking.
Yes, he discovered time travel and space travel because he's that good.
Yes.
Well, you know, maybe he's just immortal. I mean, he's Sherlock Holmes. He detectived his way into being, I don't know, cryogenically frozen or what have you.
There you go.
But
with lens flares.
All right. So I think we are about out of time. So I for all of you, those of you who sent us in emails, we did not have time to get to them because I don't want to invite a guest over and then read him our emails for like, you know, half.
Yeah.
So we will get to those next week.
We'll have a double portion of emails next week.
Yeah, they might be piling up by then. I'm going to need to get out my email shovel. get them off the lawn. But thank you very much for joining us, Patrick. Where can listeners go if they want to find out things about you and listen to the stuff that you do?
Tell us.
I have a website called atfmb.com. It's all things for my brain. That's my website. That's where I do things like Scrivener Quick Tips and talk about, you know, my own fiction writing and all that kind of good stuff. And there's links to all my stories where you can buy them. I also do the podcast at sfsignal.com and functionalnerds.com. And I produce I Should Be Writing, the podcast for wannabe fiction writers, hosted and created by Mer Lafferty.
Which is awesome. And we had her on the show.
Pretty much wonderful. And pretty much, I mean, I'm all things from my brain. So if you go to Twitter, ATFMB, that's me. Facebook.com/ATFMB, that's me. And then ATFMB.com is my website. So.
All right. Well, thank you very much. I think we are going to wrap it up for this week. David, can you lead us out with some music?
Yep. And we're going to go with some Star Trek VI, The Undiscovered Country.
All right.